This is somewhere between theoretical cosmology and general relativity, and in particular, I'm interested in using strong gravity phenomena to learn or search for new physics. And what I'm talking about in terms of new physics here, I'm showing how, in this light, all the galaxies, stars, and planets, all that we call ordinary matter, only makes up about 5% of the total amount of the universe. And this part here, we understand it pretty well, to some extent, within the context of general relativity and the standard model. It's what I'm showing you here. So not only we've been able to see this ordinary matter through electromagnetic radiation using telescopes for hundreds of years, now we also have access to the gravitational radiation by studying gravitational waves, which come in these two flavors in standard general relativity. These two polarization modes that are the H plus and H cross that I'm showing here. So this stretch and squeezing of space-time is encoded in what we call the strain waveform, which basically parameterizes this amount of stretching versus time and encodes information about the progenitor of these events. So for example, here I'm showing the waveform for a binary black hole merger of, or you can see how the early part of the signal is just a low frequency in spiral, then the binary loses energy through gravitational radiation, so it comes closer. The frequency becomes higher, then you have the merger when the two black holes form a common horizon, and then the ring down of the remnant black hole. So to detect this signal, something that is super important is having waveform models, and in particular, computational models, where we can just scan through the data and pick up signals that are even below the sensitivity or below the noise of the data that detectors have been getting. But moreover, something that is very useful, or the reason why having template models is very important, is because we can do parameter estimation. So here I'm showing a movie by Chris North and Mark Hannam at Cardiff University, where you can see how by scanning through all these template models and trying to fit the data, we can learn things about the total mass of the system or the distance in this particular case. Okay. But as I was saying, this is only what I would call ordinary matter, the 5% of the universe. We know that there is a dark component of the universe, which is at least 25% of dark matter and 70% of dark energy. And whilst this GR plus standard model works pretty well to explain this 5% here, if one wants to address these issues here, these dark components, one really needs to go beyond this. And here I'm going to be super schematic, and I'm going to say that if you want to address these two questions, you can take two approaches, mostly. So on the one hand, you can change the GR Lagrangian, so you add new forces, so you assume that GR is not the complete theory of gravity, and you just go beyond that by adding new forces. And in the context of dark matter, you might want to add new particles to the standard model. But in any of these two cases, there is one thing in common, which is that we are adding new physics to our system, our theories. And the fact that, the main evidence that we have of this 95% of the universe is through gravitational interaction, one might expect that the observational signatures of these components might be enhanced in those regimes where gravity is strong. So one place where we could think that there is a strong gravity phenomena happening is in the early universe. So for example, here, if you have some inhomogeneities at inflation that are very large, if you have reheating forming oscillons, or if you have phase transitions where bubbles can nucleate, or you can have topological defects such as cosmic strings that collapse. So this is something that I'm not going to be covering in this talk, but if you are interested in any of these three things, please come and talk to me later. Because today I'm going to be talking about the other regime where gravity is strong, which is near black holes. And in particular, I'm going to be splitting this talk in two parts. So the first part is going to be addressing the dark matter question. So how, if you have additional matter near the binary, how that can change the waveform signal in some distinctive way. And the second part of the talk is going to be, how if you have additional degrees of freedom or that couple to the Ricci scalar, so if you have new gravitational forces, how that can source new gravitational wave signatures. But before talking about that, just very basic, I think in this audience, this is not really useful, but okay. Well, I can just remind you how we do this. It's just by solving GR in a computer, we need to solve the full nonlinear set of Einstein's equations, which in a covariant form are written in this very beautiful way. If you want a t-shirt, a tattoo or something, you just do this. But then in terms of solving this numerically, here space and time are really mixed up or messed up. So what we do is solve it as an initial value problem. Basically, we split or we decompose these equations using the standard ADM formalism, BSSM reformulation into this initial value form where you can just write these equations as time derivatives of the metric equals to some source, equals to some right-hand side. And the idea is basically that you take the full spacetime, you slice it with three-dimensional hyperslices that then evolve according to some normal vector. So just the toy model here, imagine that you have a 1+1 code, you have space, time, you discretize space and time. Now you put some initial data, and this I should say that this is non-trivial. For GR, you cannot just put whatever you want. You really need to put something that satisfies the GR constraints. And this thing, which seems so naive, is usually like at least 50% of the difficulty of a problem. In the case you're doing it, okay, yeah. Which is what we I'm gonna be talking about, yeah. The next thing, basic thing, is you just impose some boundary conditions, and then by just doing this, you use Einstein's equations to fill the rest of this graph here. So for example, something that is quite nice is, let's say you put Schwarzschild black holes as initial data, it satisfies the constraints, you can put two of them, it's linear, you just put them. Now, boundary conditions, you can just put some asymptotically flat boundary conditions, and then just using Einstein's equations, you know, two black holes merge, form a common horizon, you can study the gravitational waves. So the other ingredient that is quite important, it's not essential, but it's very useful for what we are doing, is adaptive mesh refinement. So it turns out that in numerical simulations, we often have different scales that we want to track. So for example, if you have an equal mass black hole system, you want to resolve the big one, also the small one, and the resources that you need, or the resolution that you need to resolve each of these, is they don't need to be the same, basically. And more in cosmology, if we think about cosmology, we might want to resolve the Hubble horizon, so you know, large scales of the universe, but also the local dynamics of black holes or other systems. So imagine that I have here my grid, and I have here some blob of matter, let's say it's a neutron star. One way I could just improve the resolution on this blob is just by doubling resolution everywhere. But then the problem is that this is not very efficient, in the sense that I'll be putting too much resolution here where nothing interesting is happening, and maybe here I will still need to put more. So there is some balance that, or some efficiency that I should improve here. So what I say, or what we use with adaptive mesh refinement, is we use some tagging criteria, so for example, the gradient of the density, where we can just tag some cells, for example, if there is something interesting around there, to just refine them there. And given that we have this criteria, as the dynamics is happening, this new level should just follow the dynamics of this neutron star or object that we are studying. So the code that we use is GR-Chombo, which is an open source numerical relativity code with adaptive mesh refinement that is mostly developed in the UK. Here you can see a binary black hole, but in particular this super nice movie by Pau Figueras, where they cite a higher dimensional black hole, and you can see how the adaptive mesh is really following very nicely the core of this.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
If somebody was a newcomer to this field, would there be just an off-the-shelf code that does this that they could use, or does everybody write their own?
No, this is, you could just take this, and we have a wiki where you can just start using it easily in a sense.
Sorry, do you have it, or it's just like, I just don't know the field. Is this something that everybody uses the same common code? Or?
Well, no. I mean, there are different codes depending on your needs. For example, if you are doing binary black holes, maybe you would use some others that are BAM, or those that are more specific for binary black holes. Some of them, they might not be public. So this one is the one that we use in, so we are like a group of 30 people or so.
Did you write your own?
So we have the main core code, which is public, which is binary black holes and scalar fields. And then if you want to go beyond that, you can write on top of that. But so far what we have public is GR with scalar fields. Yeah. If you are interested, let's talk later if you want, yeah.
Lay in the land.
Good. So going back to, yes?
Why Chombo? Why is it called Chombo?
Oh, right. So, well, GR-Chombo is built on a library that is called Chombo. So it's basically all the, most of the fancy Runge-Kutta steps and all of the evolution are based on this Chombo library, which is very well known in the context of adaptive mesh refinement. The reason why it's called Chombo is because it's tool in Swahili. So Chombo, that's what it means, yeah. And GR Chombo is just because we built GR on top of this Chombo library. Yeah.
Swahili, is it?
Yeah. I don't know why they chose that. I mean, this is really quite old code.
Is that because you're cultural misappropriation?
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. OK. But going back to this part, so I'm going to split this in two parts, as I said. So first thing I'm going to be talking about this part here. How, if you have dark matter around black holes, how can that may change the signal that I'm showing here. So, well, first thing to note is that there is a vast range of potential dark matter masses. Here I'm going to be very schematic. I'm going to say that, okay, it's either light or heavy. People have, and when I say about light, it's, you know, sub EEB, something that could be like axions, or if it is a heavy dark matter, it could be like something like waves. People have simulated this in cosmology, and they saw that they both can kind of give you the same structure, in the sense that, you know, you form these filaments and with these voids. And some of the difference that you may find is that wave dark matter, or these light dark matter candidates, they provide some filaments that are smoother than the particle dark matter cases. So here, what I'm going to be splitting between wave dark matter and particle dark matter, and it has to do with the Compton wavelength of the dark matter particle. So in this case, if the Compton wavelength of the dark matter particle is about the size of the, you know, Schwarzschild or the black hole that we are studying, then the wave-like nature is important, and we're going to call this wave-like dark matter. If on the other hand, the Compton wavelength, so if you are considering very heavy dark matter where the Compton wavelength is much shorter than the relevant black hole horizon, then the wave-like nature is completely relevant, and we call that dark particle dark matter. So I'm going to be comparing all these two cases all the time, and in particular, I'm going to be focusing on new results on this wave-like dark matter case. But the first thing is that, okay, if you take two black holes, you put a homogeneous dark matter around them, are you going to expect to see any, you know, any observational signature of this? Well, the bad news is that dark matter density is super, super tiny. It's very low. So then we are already losing here. It's pretty hard to see this. So then we have to go beyond this dark, average dark matter density. So the question that we may want to ask is, what is the dark matter density enhancement that you might need to see any potential signatures in the binary? And whether these mechanisms happen, you know, naturally, or you need like some fine-tuned system. So here I'm going to classify these dark matter overdensity scenarios in three different cases. So the first one is superradiance. Imagine that you have a dark matter that is extracting energy from a spinning black hole and builds a cloud. The second case could be exotic compact objects. So you have this dark matter that can clump into compact objects that can act as mimickers of binary black holes, for example. But the one I'll be talking about today is something that I believe is a bit more simple, which is just how dark matter can create some overdensities just by pure accretion. So in the particle dark matter case, remember, just heavy dark matter, Condola and Silk found how just by pure having some potential well, you can form these overdensities of dark matter, which are described by some power law here, where gamma is just some factor of order between 1 and 10. And the idea is that if you have this you know, overdensity of dark matter on one of the black holes and you have another one going around them, they might feel this force or this dynamical friction force that could create some defacing on the in-spiral signal. So in the wave dark matter case, something similar happens. So imagine that you have some, as we're saying, wave dark matter is something very light. So then if it is a spin zero particle, then you can treat it as a classical field and you can just evolve the Klein-Gordon equation. So if you assume that you have some asymptotic energy density, so here I'm showing how we are modeling the dark matter with a scalar field. So in this plot here, the black hole is at the center. We have some asymptotic energy density of the dark matter field. And also this corresponds to some asymptotic value of the scalar field. And as I play this, you see how this oscillation just creates some overdensity that is some power of R. Actually, people can calculate this analytically, and you find that these are the Hoyne functions. But the idea is the same then in wave dark matter. You can form these overdensities that then could create some defacing via dynamical friction or just accretion. OK, so this is the first thing. So nature is providing some mechanism to, you know, create these overdensities naturally.
Yeah. So is the mechanism making this overdensity just, you know, I mean, well, so what is the mechanism?
Yes, gravity. Yes, gravity pulling it in. Yeah.
Well, okay, right. So is that assuming adiabatic contraction?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's adiabatic growth, really, in the case of a particle dark matter. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So then, is it valid to assume that that the growth of these central black holes will be adiabatic from the viewpoint of these dark matter particles?
Sorry, say that again.
How valid is this adiabatic? I can easily imagine that for like realistic galactic black holes, their formation will not be adiabatic.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, I don't like the particle dark matter case. In the wave dark matter case, something that maybe I should have mentioned is it's true that I don't think this happened due adiabatic growth. This is just because there are two scales here, the mass of the black hole and the mass of the dark matter particle. And it is in those cases where those are they have like comparable sizes where you can grow this profile here. So if you go beyond two different scales and you make these scales very differently, you might not form these upper densities. I don't know about the particle dark matter case, to be honest. Yeah.
So for this wave dark matter case, this dark matter, you're not considering super radius?
No, this is a Schwarzschild black hole, just immersed in a bath of dark matter. And just by having accretion, it's just growing this cloud around it. Yeah.
Okay.
The growth is not super fast either. In super radiance, you might expect this growth to be much faster. Yeah.
So the wave function, let's say, of this wave dark matter does not have any angular momentum?
Not in this case, no. In this particular case, no. I mean, in this last paper here, you can see how if you put spin in black hole, you find the same thing. It's just that instead of exciting you start exciting higher modes, basically, of the scalar field profiles. Yeah.
Okay.
But this is the simplest case. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah?
How many swarm theories
just by accretion. You are just clumping things around the black hole, basically.
And this R star is to do this sometimes.
Exactly, yeah. The black hole is here at zero, and then, yeah. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Good. Any more questions? Okay. Well, this is the first thing. You can generate these overdensities. But now the question is whether these overdensities can persist during the in-spiral or during a black hole merger. So in the particle dark matter case, people found this thing here. So this is a super nice simulation by Gianfranco Bertoni and collaborators where you can see two equal mass black holes that are, you know, are orbiting each other. They have this particle dark matter around them, and you can see how at every encounter, they are just radiating all this particle dark matter. So this is pretty sad because then by the time they merge, you might not expect to see any dark matter around the black hole. So then the effect that they should have in the in-spiral or in the gravitational wave signal should be pretty small. But this is why most of times when people talk about this defacing, they talk in the context of extreme mass ratio in spirals, because in that case, what you have is a really massive black hole, something very small, so the big black hole creates this overdensity, and then the small one is not large enough to really, you know, like destroy this dark matter cloud, but still can feel this defacing in the gravitational wave signal. So in the wave dark matter case, which is something that we did in this paper last year, here I'm showing you some simulations in fixed background, so we are evolving two black holes in fixed orbits. These are 2D slices of the simulation. Here I'm showing you the scalar field. This is the density. There are two black holes here, and as I play this, you're gonna see how the dark matter cloud grows. So these white lines are basically the value of the scalar field and density at the center, so between the binary. And something that is quite important is that you are gonna grow, there is like some sweet spot of the dark matter mass where you are gonna grow this cloud, which is when the Compton wavelength of this dark matter particle is about the size or the separation of this binary. So as I play this, you see how the scalar field is oscillating. And what the binary is doing in this case is like acting as a swing. You can see how this oscillation is becoming larger and larger in the potential. And the effect that this has on this right plot is how the density at the center is just growing. So you see how you are building some dark matter cloud around it.
So the black hole is just two superposed black holes that you move right now?
It's moving in fixed orbits in this case, yeah. Yeah.
So what are the typical separations that you need to consider here?
Right, so this is, so in this case, you would be testing, so it depends on the separation that you choose, right? So we have this freedom to just scale everything. But for example, if you are thinking about a Lisa band, or binaries that you would see in the Lisa band, that would test masses of dark matter that are about 10 to the minus 17 eV. In the LIGO one, it would be about 10 to the minus 9 eV. Yeah.
So what's special about the two black holes here? It's just the background is you're just growing the cloud.
Yeah.
So you could have guessed these answers based on the previous.
Well, in the particle dark matter case, we saw how if you put one black hole, grows this cloud. But then you put two equal black holes, you orbit them, and it turns out that they disrupt the cloud. And here what we are finding is it's not. You actually get like a really well-supported cloud in the case of wave dark matter. Yeah.
So what's wrong?
Hmm?
So what's wrong in the area? So suppose I believe this. So why is it that they are?
Well, it's not that they are wrong. It's just the way the heavy dark matter behaves just differently.
Because you just chose different.
Different masses, basically. Yeah, it's just.
Right. No, but I thought, you know, suppose you go to the case and you show the single starting on black hole, then go to the top. So based on that result, you could have guessed this is the behavior, right?
I don't know if I could have guessed that. I don't know. I don't know.
So the wavelength larger than the binary separation here?
Yeah, so basically, if you choose very short wavelength, you are not going to grow that much of a cloud. If you choose the wavelength too large, you are not going to grow the cloud. And there is some sweet spot that is between this.
What is the wavelength used here?
So it's about 0.5 the separation, basically, of the binary. Yeah, order, it has to be order one. It doesn't really need to be like just one specific value.
Do they have any black holes?
In principle, no. We didn't do it with something else, but in principle, you should see the same thing with neutron stars, as long as they are compact, I guess. Yeah. Okay, well, this is the first result. So what we find is that there is a stationary profile. So here I'm showing you the, again, this is radius. So there is one black hole here. There should be another one here. We're just cutting it because it has this reflection symmetry. And what you can see is that we start with some constant homogeneous bath of scalar field, and just within 2, 4, and 6 orbits, the profiles just become the same. And when I say the same, is we're normalizing this by the initial, the scalar field at the center of the binary.
So
same thing for the density, yeah?
You probably said this, but I think I missed it. Are you assuming the black holes are not rotating?
Yeah, yeah, these are Schwarzschild black holes that are just doing this, and they are not filling the scalar field on top of them, yeah.
Wouldn't you expect the sources you'd be interested in would be rotating?
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's something that we could just try to do next thing. Just see how that changes if you assume that the black holes have spin themselves, yeah.
I mean, it seems like maybe a really big effect because of the super radiance, there would be a kind of source of extra field.
Yeah, well, I think super radiance here might not have really much to play, basically, because these timescales of the growth of this cloud are very short timescales. And I would expect that in super radiance, you will need much, much longer timescales to see any growth. But I mean, Niels or Will can tell this much better than myself. Yeah. But OK, so there is this scaling symmetry. What I mean is that the shape of the cloud is not changing and it's just growing. So something that we might want
to
ask is.
Yeah. Suppose you couldn't have guessed that, but now you look at this.
Yeah.
With a single black hole,
yeah.
The profile is similar,
Wait, so by knowing this single case, you could guess that each of them are going to grow, but then what you couldn't guess is that if they are in a binary, whether they are going to shoot this cloud away or not.
Sure, but now you have it. So
yeah.
You throw away the cloud, and now you have, if I zoom in on the black hole, this profile is similar to the one.
No, not really. Look, because you can see how. Near, so the other black hole is here, so it's not symmetric anymore, for example. So it has different shapes, basically. And probably the growth rate is also a bit different, but I don't know the answer to that, yeah.
If you make the size of the orbit smaller than the cosmic, these won't show like these sort of structure.
Yeah, or it might just show, but it won't grow as fast as it is growing in this case.
So it's gonna stop, so if you think you have a black
at some point it might stop, yeah.
So it's growing because of accretion, or it's growing because you...
Because accretion.
Because of accretion.
Yeah.
So the binary motion has not injected any energy to the cloud.
Well, the binary motion is really the thing that is making this oscillation here. So if you have a binary that is fixed, they will also grow. So that's true, just by having a fixed binary. But as soon as you give this, that gives extra energy into the scalar field that is going to make it grow faster.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there some resonance that's happening, you're saying, between the
position
period of the axiom and the binary?
Yeah, so people ask whether there is a resonance. We usually don't like to say resonance because it's not like a sweet spot, really, like a one point where this only happens. It's like a continuous, you know, if you explore through the mass of the scalar field, you can see how you are getting better clouds or more consistent clouds, and then at some point it switches off. But I wouldn't call that really a resonance in the context of... Sorry?
Are the two frequencies commensurate?
Yeah, they are about the same order, but they don't really need to be exactly the same. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, something that we want to check is whether, you know, what are the right initial conditions to put on our simulation. So, for example, if you consider other people's work, what they usually do is you put some Gaussians on top of that instead of evolving in this fixed orbit. And then here, I'm just studying four different cases. So these fixed orbits are the ones that I was just talking that we generate them with this fixed background. So these two here are extended dark matter clouds, basically. So they get to the infinite. So you have an infinite reservoir of dark matter. And these ones, they are isolated in the sense that we just cut them. So you have a finite amount of dark matter that can grow. And here I'm showing, again, same plot as before. And I'm showing the four profiles that we're studying. And what you, as I play this, you're going to see, so in this case, we are already not doing some fixed orbit simulations. We are evolving a binary, but there is no back reaction. And we want to explore how these clouds evolve, basically. So what you can see is that, you know, after a few orbits, there are two classes of dark matter clouds. And whether it's this one or this one, it has to do whether it is extended or isolated. If it is extended, you have infinite dark matter, so you can just keep growing, and that's what you get. And if it is isolated, you have a finite amount of dark matter that can form a cloud. But the interesting thing here is if you look at, for example, the yellow and the blue one, you see how the yellow stays pretty much constant, whereas the blue one is having some transients. So if you wanted to put some initial data in your GR simulations, you shouldn't be using those that are having transients. So the main result here is that they all converge to this stationary profile that we found in the fixed orbit, but they have some transients. So if you wanted to compute the gravitational signal and you're putting something that is going to have some transients, be careful because your waveform is going to have some artificial, I mean physical, but spurious radiation, really.
So yeah. Are you showing there's an initial time?
Yeah, so this is the initial time, yeah, exactly.
Then if you play sufficiently the Gaussian, the first one, right?
So the Gaussian looks also. So if you look at the Gaussian here, within two orbits is the pink one, the green one. You see how it's looking pretty much like this one, like the fixed orbit one that is with that has some finite amount of dark matter. Yeah. But the thing is that it's having some transients in between. Yeah.
Sorry, in this the fixed orbit.
Yeah.
So when you start evolving the scalar field, does it reach that saturation at some point?
We didn't see that. In principle, it should, but we didn't get that.
How do you choose the initial point at which you say, okay?
So that's a free choice for us. We didn't find a place where it saturates. There might be, but we didn't find it. We did 10 orbits, and that wasn't enough, really. Yeah. So basically, we have this scaling symmetry. So what we have a free choice of the density, optimal density, basically. Yeah. Okay, but what about dark matter versus no dark matter, right? That's what we want to see. And the answer is very disappointing, so because we're not there yet, so don't get excited about it. but the first thing is now we have these clouds, we know what is the right initial condition that we should put on top of this binary, but we need to solve the constraints. And it turns out that solving the constraints is pretty hard in vacuum. If you have fundamental fields, it's even harder. So something that we did is solving the Hamiltonian momentum constraint. We just choose what we call the hybrid CTTK method, which we describe in this paper, basically choosing the trace of the extrinsic curvature to just kill this density here and just solve this in an iterative wave. The problem with this is that when you solve the constraints, we are doing the right thing, but the dark matter is pushing the black holes to highly eccentric orbits. So the way to think about that is, okay, we have some vacuum binary, which has some velocity that gives you 10 orbits. Now, on top of this, we put a cloud that we generated. Now, you solve the constraints. Now, these velocities are changing to something that there are not 10 orbits anymore. So then there is really not meaningful comparison yet. And this is what you can see here. So this is the orbital radius, so the distance, the separation between the black holes as a function of time. You can see how the g equals to 0 gives you 10 orbits. But as soon as you start exploring different profiles, you have eccentricity and things become just too crazy. Yeah. Yeah, so that's the one that's the vacuum one that we would like to compare to. But the lesson that we are learning,
I just want to get some intuitive understanding here.
Yeah.
So if you consider this sphere, right, with radius of, let's say, boundary separation,
mm-hmm.
So how does this dark matter mass enclosed in this sphere compare to the black hole mass?
Compared to what, sorry?
The black hole mass. So the dark matter mass within.
Yeah, okay, so in these cases, the cloud that we are putting is about 10 to the minus 5, the mass of the black hole. So it's pretty small.
So it's super, okay.
It's super small. The problem is that if you have overdensities, for example, the green and yellow are these fixed orbit ones that have these overdensities near the black holes. So even though the mass is very small of this cloud, the fact that you have high density near the black holes is what pushes it to very different trajectories.
Oh, okay.
So then what somebody will need to do here is, okay, do some eccentricity reduction so that you get quasi-circular in spirals, and then you can compare to the vacuum black hole case, but we don't have that yet.
So what's your vacuum mass of the cloud that you're growing in one black hole?
Yeah, sorry, so this is so this 10 to minus 5 in this case.
10 to minus 5.
Yeah. But you can see that all of them have 10 to the minus 5, but the thing that matters for this cake is really the local density. You know, you, if you have 10 to the minus 5 around a huge area, you are not really, that's the case of the homogeneous case, you are not really going to see this effect. But if you have all of these near the black holes, that's when you're going to get a huge cake.
So if I compute the mass as well,
you would have to compute the black hole, that's 10 to the minus 5. No, so it's the total one, yeah. So we have a cloud, right? And then we integrate over this cloud. And in all of these cases, they are 10 to the minus 5. Now,
10 to the minus 5 in which case, with respect to the mass?
To the mass of a black hole.
But then if I look at Raman...
Exactly, the distribution of this mass is going to be different. Yeah. So in the case of...
It has such a huge impact.
So in FO and FOI, the fixed orbit ones, all this matter, all this 10 to the minus 5, is really clamped into a small region near the black holes. And that's why you have a huge effect. Yeah.
It's surprising you have such a huge effect.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's still 10 to the minus 5 in mass.
It's 10 to the minus 5 in mass, but then if you look at the density, right, if it is really highly peaked density near the black holes, that's going to have a huge effect, yeah.
All right, but I could imagine I change the black hole mass. So I'm going back to the other, and I change the black hole, and put the same momentum, but I change the black hole by 10 to the minus 5. It's surprising that it's going to
That's
okay. Run from 2,000 to 400. So it seems that what you're saying is also changing the momentum.
That's a good point.
Maybe it's not
just,
what's the problem with the angular momentum?
Sorry, I don't...
Maybe that the angular momentum transfer to the cloud may be non-negligible?
Yeah.
But it should be huge.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, I do not have the answer to that, yeah. But it's true that it's not only the mass, it's also the momentum, the way we are integrating this, right, in the constraints. We are basically feeding here something.
Yeah.
So it's really changing the mass and this thing, that the thing that is kicking it to different directions. That's a really good point, actually, what you're saying, yeah. I should have a look. Okay, but just to summarize this first part, well, the first thing, first result is that we have some persistent and quasi-stationary profile for accretion as opposed to the particle dark matter case. Then all the profiles go to this attractor profile, but transients are important. And then future work is, okay, we are still not there to do this one-to-one comparison with the vacuum binary. Yes?
I had a question about this transient thing, this quasi-circular. So I guess you want that because you want to compare exactly with some But maybe I'm wrong, but if you had this matter around the black holes, does that mean that this eccentric orbits should be more?
That's a really good point. That's something that we want to explore. First thing is that we don't even know whether the dark matter is going to create eccentric orbits, basically. And that would be a huge thing, because that would be a smoking gun, right? If we started seeing like many eccentric orbits, that would mean, how is this eccentricity being generated? So that's a good point, yeah. So regarding this point, I'm saying that we should get quasi-circular in spirals. Now, I don't know if that's the right or the natural initial conditions for these dark matter clouds with the black holes. Yeah, what point?
I mean, if you could explore that from the black hole starting at larger separation volume.
That would be great. Yeah, if we could just start simulations like 1,000 orbits earlier, we start with some density that is very low, and we let this cloud evolve for thousands of orbits, that would be fantastic. Yeah.
So yeah. Why do you think it will boost the eccentricity?
Because I mean, it seems like you're having a hard time to actually get the right initial condition. So maybe it's because the natural thing of this dark matter around black holes, you actually increase.
Yeah, and the density of the dark matter is not really symmetric around the black hole. So you can't really just be kicking it in some asymmetric way that will create some eccentricity. Yeah. So that could be, but I do not know. Yeah. Yeah.
So just go back to the discussion. So. How exactly are you studying the velocity of this
kind? So we start with this homogeneous bath, right? It's a zero velocity.
Yeah.
Now we put these fixed orbit simulations that have, you know, the basically just Kepler's law, depending on the distance, we get what the angular velocity should be. That creates some cloud, and that's the cloud that we put. So we don't really, the velocity of the scalar field is not a choice for us. It's whatever is given to us by the binary, by the fixed orbit simulations.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm happy to take more questions about this on the at the end, but now I'm gonna move to the second part, which is how things change about new for, if you add new forces. It's a bit relevant. But the idea is that now the scalar field, instead of living only on the, you know, some extension to the standard model, if it has some coupling to the Ricci scalar, as it is the case for many Hollandsky theories, in addition to having these two polarization modes, we have a new one, which is the scalar mode, or this breathing mode, which will stretch and squeeze LIGO detectors in this way. And you might think that LIGO and Virgo, they are not sensitive to this, but it's just that the optimal configuration of LIGO, of these two arms, is actually the only place where this wouldn't detect it, basically, because you have the same stretching. But as soon as you average over all sky locations, it's about one third less sensitive than the plus and cross polarization. So in this part, I'm going to be focusing on this mode here. And in particular, I'm going to be interested in the ringdown, just because the ringdown has these quasi-normal mode frequencies that are universal and encode information about the black holes as the mass or the spin. But something that you cannot get with perturbative calculations are the amplitudes. So if you want to make some forecast of how easy to detect these things are, you really need to run this, you know, look at the waveform of the ringdown and look at these amplitudes. So this is a toy model. So we want to generate these scalar modes. And you know, you have different ways of doing it. If you are doing some scalar Gauss-Bonnet, you can generate a scalar or this scalar radiation. In this case, what we are studying is some scalar field profile. Is like a loop that is going to collapse, form a black hole, and it's going to emit gravitational waves in this psi 4 scalar and this scalar mode here. So these, again, 2D slices of my simulations. So as I play this, this loop collapses, forms a black hole. You have some spurious radiation, as usually in NR. But here you see merger or black hole formation and ring down. And this is what you can see in the scalar mode. So again, this is just a toy model for how this, how we can generate this radiation and how it propagates. Yeah, I'll show you why that's the case. But now what we want to study is why or how is this propagating? And the way we do this is by extracting at some radius here and extracting at two different radius. We overplot the waveforms and we see how different they are. So in the tensor waveform, I'm showing you here, this is just the ringdown, but just in logarithmic scale. And I'm plotting this standard units here, like t minus r, retarded time, and also multiplying r times h. So that if I extract at two different radius, right, and I overplot them, if they overlap, basically, that means that they decay as 1 over r, and also that they travel at the speed of light. So here you see the event, it has some black hole formation, and then the quasi-normal mode ring down. I extract at two different radius, and they match when I plot them in these coordinates.
Sorry, what do you mean by tensor waveform?
Hmm?
What's
so this h plus, or h cross. Oh, in our case, it's just h plus, yeah. So what you see is that by extracting at these two different radius, you are getting that, you know, things are traveling at the speed of light and you have 1 over r decay. So these are just standard massless waveforms.
Why are you looking at 2, 0?
Because in this case, we have a loop and this loop has some axial symmetry. So then the dominant mode that you excite is the 2, 0 mode. Yeah. Any other questions? So now if I do the same for the scalar mode, so here you can see how you have some exponential bring down. So they have this exponential decay, and also this frequency is going to give you the real part of the quasi-normal mode frequencies. You check this with GR or with the theory that you're studying, it appears pretty nicely. Fine. What about the scalar mode? Well, if I look at the scalar mode, this event that we used as toy model was loud enough to create higher modes. So here you see the 2-0 mode and the 4-0 mode. And again, I'm plotting the same x and y axis. And what you can see is that now when I overplot two different radius, I'm not getting they are not matching, basically. So I'm already seeing that things are propagating at small that speed of light. But the thing that is really bothering me here is that I wanted to study ring down. And if I plot this in linear scale, now I plot it again in logarithmic scale, you see that for the 2-0 and for the 4-0, if I look at the late time behavior, there are just some power law tails, t2 minus 2 and t2 minus 4. But there is not really exponential ring down, even though a black hole formed and I saw the ring down in the tensor waveform. Yeah, exactly. So if I look at the wave equation, right, basically at linear order, the wave equation that I'm solving is basically given by this equation here, where Vs is the Reggie-Wheelier potential, forget about all of these terms. They depend on the model you're studying, the mass. Anyways, just think about this as far away. So you take R to infinity. Basically, this scalar mode is evolving with some massive wave equation in flat space, pretty much. Now, we know how to solve this. We can put some wave ansatz. And it turns out that if you put this, you need to satisfy some dispersion relation so that the frequency has to be related to the wave vector and the mass in this form. So if you find the wave vector, what it is, you find this funny part here. And you know you have a square root of something that can be negative, so you should worry. So there are two ranges here, right? So if the frequency of these waves are smaller than the mass, then you have some Yukawa suppression. So this thing just decays exponentially, and they do not propagate. But now if you are having waves that have higher frequency than the mass, those ones should propagate. Now, how do they propagate? Well, they have some dispersion relation, which means that different frequencies are going to propagate at different speeds, as you can see here, right? So if I take the frequency to infinity, for example, those are going to propagate at the speed of light, pretty much. But if I take the frequency of these waves that I'm exciting as to be of order the mass, then those are not going to propagate. And this is something that you could already have seen or guessed in this plot here. So again, this is the 2-0 and 4-0 mode. Higher modes have higher frequencies. And you can see here how the peak of these signals are coming at later times. Basically, the 4-0 is coming a bit earlier than the 2-0. Now, if I plot the power of the tensor and scalar modes, you can see the same thing. The tensor mode, as we said, was massless, so it propagates at the speed of light. You get the first thing. Now, you get the 4-0 mode, then you get the 2-0 mode. So you are saying that this is the reason why things are not propagating at the speed of light. But now, let's think about the binary black hole, which is not what I'm showing.
Sorry.
Yeah.
You're also saying that the amplitude follows the power law decay itself.
In time, yeah.
Instead of exponential decay.
Yeah.
If you work out the frequencies, right, you're assuming it's a exponential decay. Like, why do you get a power law decay here?
Well, I mean, you just write and you see that you are not getting exponential decay. So there is no ring down what you are seeing. And this is just the fact that, as I'm going to describe in a bit, the way waves are propagating, you know, you have a wave packet that is not the secret, is not monochromatic. You have different frequencies. So you are just scrambling the signal in some way that at the end you are getting things that go as a power law. Yeah. So things propagate at different speeds. But the thing that I really care about now, and this is something that shocked my mind a bit, is that if you now think about the binary black hole case, the chronology of the event is going to be changed in the sense that the fact that when this propagates, you have different frequencies propagating at different speeds is going to basically change the waveforms at emission compared to detection. So what I mean by this is imagine we're here. We have some binary black hole out there. Now, these are massless tensor waveforms. So then the first thing that we see is low frequency, you know, and that's the first thing that emits the binary, then higher frequency, and then the ring down. As everything is traveling at the speed of light, you know, you first emit the in-spiral merger ring down. That's the way we get it. There is no scrambling here. But now, as soon as you have a massive, and this is what you can see in the spectrogram, right? You see how first we get low frequencies, high frequencies. And yeah, probably you won't hear this, but okay, you can imagine the sound that this makes. I'm not gonna make it. I'll do it for the scalar mode. So now, in this case where you have this massive scalar mode, right? What is happening is that the first thing that the binary would emit is the low frequency. What's the problem with the low frequency? That travels at the smallest speeds. So then the first thing that is emitted is traveling at smaller speeds, and then the next things can catch up and basically reverse the signal. And you could get something like an inverse chirp. Exactly, so now you would get higher frequencies going to lower frequencies. And if I just take the spectrogram of one of my simulations, this is actually what we are seeing here, that there is some inverse chirp. But what this is saying, and by the way, this is something that people have studied already in core collapse supernovae in the context of scalar tensor, but in spherically symmetric case where they don't have tensor modes, but they just have this massive scalar mode. So if I plot the spectrogram for the 2-0 mode, okay, different things that you can see here. So this is the mass cutoff. The thing that I was saying, if you have frequencies below this frequency, below the mass, basically, you are not going to propagate them. And now, what you can see here is that if I overplot the prediction for quasi-normal mode frequencies, you get them here. So same thing for the 4-0 mode. You don't get anything below the mass cutoff, and you get an inverse chirp here. Now, ring down should be somewhere there. It's just that it's completely scrambled. Is there any way we can recover it? I mean, one way we could recover this is by imagine that we have some magic powers and we can just go near the black hole and observe the ring down there. Because if we get very close to this system here, that's where they are emitting the things, you know, first merger, in spiral merger and ring down. But we cannot do that. So what we thought of doing is rewinding the signal. We know how it propagates to infinity. We extract it at infinity. What about just taking it at infinity, rewind it back near the source, and see whether we can extract the ring down there? So here I'm showing the extraction radius in our simulation bus. It's about 125. And as I play this, this is going to become closer to 5M or 2M. Basically, I'm going to be rewinding the signal. This same signal, I'm going to be rewinding it back to the black hole using this effective massive wave equation. So as I play this, see that we are just getting closer. Signal is just changing. It's about 50M, 40M, 30M, whatever. And something that was an inverse chirp became a chirp. Remember, this is not a binary black hole, but still, think about it as if it was, because it's the same thing. So now if I look at the 2-0 mode, right, I struck that 125, I got this wave here. Now I rewind it back, and I get this signal here next to the black hole. I do the same thing for the 4-0, which is even more clear. You can see how an inverse chirp became like a clearer chirp, where the ring down frequency predictions are somewhere here. So now if I look at these waveforms at 5M, that's where I really should try to do the analysis and extract ring downs. Sorry, you have a question?
Sorry, yeah, I'm confused. So I guess I tell you my answer. One, if I think I'm close to source, I'm getting in trouble because I don't even know how to define
exactly
the waves or anything.
Exactly.
I need to go up. So what's the problem? I mean, I'm outside. One thing I can do is the proportional mode matching analysis will have an undetermined time, which is a time at which whatever the proportional mode needs to register. That's a parameter. It's in the, I can choose it to be independent for different problems. So why is it I cannot do the same analysis and what where LIGO is and then just search for it?
Sorry, what do you mean? Like the signals that we would detect in LIGO is something like this.
Yeah.
Right? Now, how
I lost why you're trying to make me get close to the source to define the Poisson mode.
Oh, basically because here I cannot define where the ring down is because it's been mixed with other parts of the signal.
Yeah, but
so I cannot really.
Other parts of the signal do not behave like a decaying exponential.
Yeah, exactly. They decay differently.
Yeah, so I can search for it.
Okay, I don't know how I would do it here, basically, because the first thing that I wouldn't know is where in this range?
Well, let me put it in a different way. Suppose you have a standard gravitational wave from binary black hole.
Yeah.
But you just happen to have 25 of them going on more or less at the same time.
Yeah.
If you have here in LIGO, you have the same problems. And how do you know when the Poisson mode ring down starts? You just search for the temperature they have the right property, and then you're going to dig out, oh, this signal is ringing down here, this other is ringing down there. So why is that done different from this one?
I guess I didn't try to search for the ring down here just because I mean, if I try to search here for exponentially decaying phases, I'm just not going to see anything in this part here. Unless I do some fancy analysis that I'm not aware of, of how to do it. So, but the idea is comparing to how I did for the tensor mode, right? In the tensor mode, I see this ring down clearly, and I say, oh, there's the ring down. Now, if I plot this in logarithmic scale, I just see a tail. T minus two. So the ring down should be somewhere here, but I don't know how to extract it. Basically, because the things that happened before black hole formation and after black hole formation, they have completely mixed.
I understand, but this is the same thing if you have 25 black holes emerging and more at the same.
And can LIGO
going
down, and can LIGO do this analysis pretty well? Can LIGO do like I thought this is one of the current issues really. In that sense, that if you have multiple signals at the same time, I don't think it's clear how you can extract them. So I think that's pretty hard. I don't think it's that easy as, but I could be wrong, yeah.
So you need to know this math beforehand.
I'm gonna say something about this at the end, yeah. But yeah, for this case, yeah.
So you mentioned that the chronology between the frequencies has been changed or something like that. How is it getting a reverse chip then?
Oh, you would always expect to get this inverse chirp.
My point is that I was expecting they are stronger than we are going to see something frequencies.
But remember that high frequencies are the ones that travel faster. So if you are far away, the ones that should get you first are just the high frequencies. So that's why you would expect this signal to be generic in that sense. Well, it depends how far you are. If you are infinitely far, then you know for sure that the high frequencies will arrive you first. Now, if you are in between, you know, depends on the signal, on the length of the signal, basically. So it's not.
My point is that if you're getting the perfect inverse.
Yeah, it's not going to be a perfect. Yeah.
You can find it. Yeah, the templates. If it's messed up, then we can't.
I don't know. The thing is that you will never get a perfect inverse chirp,
yeah.
Right? Because you are not, you are at some finite distance. Anyways, I cannot skip this movie. Sorry, you have to suffer it again. It took me some time to do it, so you can just. Okay, wait. Okay, so if I look at this now and I plot this thing as I was saying before, right? Now you see how where I was getting some tails. Now I get some exponential decay. And it happens right after the black hole has formed. So here's where I can really say, oh, you know, this is actually the ring down. It's happening right after black hole formation, and I have some exponential decay. And not only that, if I look at the rate at which this exponential decay is happening, is really what people predict from perturbative calculations. So this regarding the imaginary part. If I now study this ring down and I do, you know, some Fourier transform or whatever to see the real part, you see that the 2-0 and the 4-0 mode, they peak right at the place where you should be expecting. So here we can confidently say that you know, we are having some ring down, and we can extract now the amplitudes, for example.
Which equation did you use to rewind?
Yeah, so we use the flat space wave equation with some effective mass.
Okay.
I skipped that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to show that, but
okay.
You have some mass, and that mass is actually what is going to incorporate the fact that as you are getting closer, you are having curvature terms. Yeah, good. Okay, and let me just say one last thing before I finish. So one approach or one way that one could use this to, you know, learn about fundamental physics, I think it's a bit exotic, but you know, it's something that would be nice if it happened. Imagine that we have some binary, we are here, and we detect the tensor mode. And this goes back to what you are asking about the mass of the scalar field. Now, by having the tensor mode, we can have, you know, some estimate of the distance. So, you know, the luminosity distance of the event. Now imagine that around this signal, we detect some scalar component in our detector. And of course, if it is massive, it has some inverse chirp, something, you know, something that doesn't look like a right waveform. Now the fact that we know this distance allows us to take this waveform and evolve it back. We can evolve it back or rewind it with some mass. And you know, we rewind it to this distance, and we see something that doesn't look right. We rewind it with another mass, and we find something that doesn't look right. But then there is some specific mass for which when you rewind it, specifically this distance that the tensor modes were telling you, where you would find the right quasi-normal modes. So this is one way you could use, you know, by knowing the distance to the source, to learn something about the mass of this scalar field. So just to finish this part, I'm happy to take more questions afterwards. Well, in theory, it's beyond GR if you add new forces. If you might generate these scalar modes, which they, if they are massive, the chronology is mixed. Now, this is also important for people doing massive gravity, because if you are doing just massive gravity in the tensor field, this means that if you are searching for these signals, right, you shouldn't be using the right the standard waveforms, because if they are so different, they are not going to capture below the noise, basically. And the last thing that we did in this work here is rewind it, or you know, develop some method to rewind it and reconstruct the chronology, and that allowed us to extract the quasi-normal mode amplitudes. And with this, I think I'm happy to take more questions. Thank you.
Just going back to the slide, when you said the exact number of modes, you mean the one you would get from like some PN prediction?
Yes. Yeah, so exactly. So people know how to calculate these quasi-normal mode frequencies in theories beyond GR, where you have the scalar mode. So you can predict what this is. What they cannot do is predict the amplitude, but they know the frequencies. And that's what I was comparing to before. So that's what I mean, that you rewind it, and there is some specific mass for which, you know, this thing gives you the right frequencies that people were predicting. Yeah. I think it's a bit exotic, but, you know, sounds cool.
Yeah. So there, when you say you have H plus and H cross detector,
yeah.
So if I were to have a scalar mode, would that, if I'm not taking that into account, would that change at all my prediction of the?
Well, in this case, it didn't. But depends, really. I mean, that's something that Max and Will can tell you more about. If you have this instant scalar Gauss Bonnet, for example, maybe the scalar mode can back react enough to change the tensor mode. In this theory that I was studying, that was not the case.
No, I don't think I was.
Maybe
it's me not understanding how interferometers work. So I'm going to have a strain.
Yes.
That strain is not, I'm not, it's my interpretation of that strain in terms of H plus and H cross. Depends if I take into account.
If you have a scalar mode, you have to introduce a new antenna pattern that is different to the plus and cross polarization. Now I can tell you, I talked to gravitational wave people about this. So far, LIGO could say that the signals that we have detected are not purely scalar modes. That's something that they could say. What they cannot say yet is that the tensor modes have some scalar mode, because to say that you need CAGRA, you need another detector. So we are still not there yet, I think.
The scalar mode, this polarization you're talking about, is not like isotropically.
No, it's really like a transverse thing. If it was fully isotropic, you wouldn't see it with LIGO. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
You were minded to fly back.
So why? So that's something when we sent this to review to the referee, that's something that they said, like, why 5M? So we actually did 2M too. I just wanted to be like careful so that I was not getting too close to the black hole. But it turns out that if you go from 5M to 2M, things do not change much. Because this thing is really an accumulative effect in the sense that it's long distances, the things that are making this crumble. So going from 5M to 2M, it doesn't really make much of a sense. Here's what I said, okay, I'm good enough that I'm close, not super close. I'm good enough to see the ring down here. But in principle, you can just push it more, closer to 2M, yeah.
So why not 10?
I guess at 10M, I mean, if I play this and... Oh. At 10M, you are not quite there yet, I guess.
It depends on the distance of the system from us, right?
Well, the thing is that this is...
Distance shouldn't matter.
Sorry, say that again?
If
the source is super far. Yeah, exactly. So here I'm comparing 125 to, which is where I struck, to 5M. Yeah, which is not, okay, one order of magnitude. Yeah?
So by rewinding, do you just mean that you're just, you know, adding some other parameter, like a dispersion measure that we use in your radio astronomy, you know, tell you how much dispersion is happening?
Okay, that sounds more fancy than what I do. So what I do is literally just, take these signals that I extract them. I know how they've been propagating for a long time in my simulations. So I can just basically reverse that.
Okay, so similarly for the radio astronomy, propagation is also dispersive.
Okay.
So we account for that in the data just by allowing for a dispersion measure or something.
Yeah.
Dispersion has happened.
Yeah.
It sounds like by this rewinding, you just mean exactly that, right?
Hmm. Maybe, I don't know. I do not know about how people do it in that sense, so I cannot answer it really.
Yeah, I think it's just removing the propagation effect.
Well, I mean, by just evolving this, that's the way I'm removing this dispersion that has happened, by just evolving this backwards, yeah. I don't know if this is the way they do it, probably they have more fancy methods of doing that.
So for the scalar phase, you said that the mass around the binary is 10 to minus 5 and the mass of the black.
Well, for us, we measure everything in terms of M. So really, with these simulations that we simulated, you can just choose whatever mass you want. It's just that if you pick a mass for the black hole, that's going to fix the distance of the binary, and that's going to fix the mass of the scalar field that will create this resonance or this growth. Yeah. So for example, yeah.
The mass of the cloud, the gravitational mass of the cloud, or the mass of the cloud?
Oh, the mass of the black hole, the scales. Sorry, you were talking about the mass of the cloud, or?
No, I'm asking what is the mass of dark matter that they have around.
Oh, in that case that I was showing was 10 to minus 5.
So that's a huge mass.
Yeah, I agree. It can be.
So in order to just And how do you build this up, right? Because if you just divide by 0.4 GP per centimeter cubed, mm-hmm. right, this gives you a distance of, like, I assume continuous map, right? So the distance that I need to collect for the dark matter flow is like 0.1 parsec.
Okay.
It's extremely huge. At that point, the gravitational potential of the black holes themselves is much, much more subdominant than, say, the galaxies. Can I even grow this?
Well, but for growing this thing, the density does not matter really that much, right? For growing something is the mass scale. Now you're saying about growing a certain amount of mass around the binary.
How do I collect this mass?
Yeah, I mean, depending your scales that you have, right? So if you have an infinite bath, you just need long time, because as we were showing, this thing keeps growing.
Right, so time scale is one thing, but also the other thing is, if you just compare the length scale, right? You take vanilla 0.4 GV per centimeter cubed, then ask how far away from the black hole do I need to collect all the dark matter to get 10 to the minus 5 the mass of the black hole? And this is 0.1 parsec, at which point just the gravitational potential from the black hole is subdominant to the gravitational potential from the galaxy, so I wouldn't expect this dark matter to just come, you know, accumulate.
Okay. Well, maybe 10 to the minus 5 is a bit too much anyways, and we should see some effects already with 10 to the minus 8. As I was saying, like the thing that really creates...
10 to the minus, you know, 20 different.
Yeah, but maybe something that I was showing before, the thing that matters for this effect on the binary is not really the amount of mass, but it's really the density around. So you can have low density, but really, you know, highly peaked, basically. So low mass, but concentrated in a very small region, and that could have a big effect on the binary.
I don't understand how, you know, an order one change in the orbit by changing the mass of by 10 to minus 5. I just don't understand that.
Yeah. So if you just have 10 to the minus 5, like mass near black hole, right? You should just generate 10 to the minus 5 change in orbit. That's how would it
do?
By gravitational interaction.
So what do you mean? Like if you have 10 to the minus 5?
Yeah, so if the dark matter mass is 10 to the minus 5 times the black hole mass, right? So yeah, and the interaction between the dark matter and the black hole is gravitational. And
yeah, but this...
to the dark black hole.
But I think it's really the density, the right thing to look at there. It's not really how much mass you have, but how it is distributed.
Yeah, but the worst case is make it as dense as the black hole.
Yeah.
Mm.
So you make the dark matter as a black hole, and then, yeah, so it's the density. Most, the highest density you can get, but the change is still 10 to minus 5.
I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know.
Say you even grow this. So if you want to see an effect, you want this to happen near the time of coalescence, right?
Well, this could be something that accumulates over time. It doesn't really...
But you see it near coalescence.
I mean, LISA can see things that do not coalesce in the LISA band, for example, right? You could see...
My question is, how robust is this? Because you need some time for it to grow.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you need to sort of have a separation that is comparable to the mass of the...
Exactly, yeah.
The particle, right?
Yeah.
So when I have separation of scales, which is either when the binaries are very far apart or when they are very close together, How does the growth of this cloud change?
Well,
separation
I guess.
Do I have continuous growth?
So that's not something we could explore here, because here we are just having 10 orbits. So during 10 orbits, we cannot really say much. I guess for that case, you would need to study like what happens during 1,000 orbits. How does the dark matter cloud change when it was 1,000 orbits before coalescence? And what happens when it reaches 10 before coalescence? I do not know the answer to that. But
I have a related comment. So maybe I'm missing something very important, but can you do a Newtonian simulation of the system?
Yeah, so the idea for these fixed orbit simulations is basically that. So we thought that it was going to be much cheaper than doing full GR, and we could do like 100 orbits. It turns out that it's not that much cheaper.
Okay.
you know, it's not as much as we thought. So I guess.
What do you mean by Newtonian? Field?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. So I guess if you did some, you know, post-Newtonian calculation on this thing, including the effect of the scalar field, by changing that case, that could help you much more. And I, to be honest, if I was looking at only the spiral, I wouldn't do these simulations. I would just try to treat it analytically. Yeah. Is that what you meant by Newtonian?
Yeah, I mean, if you do like a proper, I guess you're taking your code as a GR code and doing some weak field.
Yeah, we basically put a metric which, you know, orbits. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, if you do it like purely Newtonian, like basically not being restricted by the speed of light, and like Newtonian simulations that people do in cosmology, for instance, then that should be a couple of.
Yeah, maybe there you could pick like more than, yeah. Yeah.
You have to write the code.
Yeah. Yeah, for us it was harder for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So, but over there, you need to consider the friction force, right?
Yeah, that's, I guess.
Well, I mean, here we are taking into account all the effects. One of the effects that we could see is this friction.
Yeah, but I don't know how it works in, like, and your case is equal mass, right?
Yeah.
I've seen in papers that, so for MVs, the friction force effect close to the black hole is very small, so you have to go further from black hole. I mean, the separation between the black hole should be large enough, because as it gets closer, then the friction or angular moments of transfer between the dark matter and the secondary black hole would decrease.
Okay.
But here, I don't know how it works, but what you're talking about is mostly for those.
Exactly, equal mass. Yeah, so the things that we can do well with NR. MRIs are very hard for us. Yeah.
Okay, no more questions. That's a usual game, by the way.
Thanks.